Arm's Length Reporting, for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. Welcome to KER Politics for the week, for the weekend, I guess I should say. We feel that we're probably the only program that the advantage that we have over some of the other programs is that we don't censor any of our listeners. So you really get a complete idea of what some very intelligent listeners are thinking about in this day and age. We're going to talk about some interesting things on the show today. We're going to talk about the possibility of utilizing nuclear weapons between Ukraine and Russia. We're going to talk a little bit about Jimmy's background in the nuclear industry, in the nuclear environment, I guess I should say. Very, very interesting. And we're going to talk also a little bit about the Chinese balloon. What have I missed, Jimmy?
We'll talk a little bit about Hunter Biden, then we'll close it up with kind of the political implications of the world right now, what's happening.
There we go.
Yeah.
Let's start out and let's talk about we had a lot of comments yesterday. I did not respond to the comments yesterday because I felt the ones that were really relevant, it was more appropriate for Jimmy to respond to them. And the reason I wanted to do that is because he has so much more background than I do and the most of you do in the environment of nuclear weapons. Jimmy, talk a little bit about your background, would you?
Yeah, you bet, Al. So in the 90s, I was in a special mission unit, SMU, primarily focused on three topics. Our job was counterterrorism, hostage rescue, and counter weapons of mass destruction. Yeah. So in that capacity, I had the absolute honor and the opportunity to go out and work with the Nuclear Emergency Support Team, the NEST, based out of it will go anywhere, but basically the organization that's responsible in case there's either a nuclear accident or nuclear weapons stolen or a nuclear weapons threat on the United States. I worked in Berlin. There was some understanding of tactical nuclear weapons and how their capacities were there. And I did my master's thesis. I did a graduate program and worked as an intern with the Pacific Northwest Nuclear Laboratory after my tour in the Republic of Georgia, understanding what the potential damages would be from a radiological dispersal device, an RDD. And you know what? I guess I have a pretty deep understanding. I'm not an expert by any means, but I have a pretty deep understanding of what the difference between a tactical and a strategic nuclear weapon is, and of course what the damages are with even just nuclear material.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to understand, to have when you're looking at the potential use of nuclear weapons or tactical nuclear weapons in the Ukraine theater by Russian forces.
Jimmy, before we get off on that topic, I'd like to discuss your opinion and my opinion as to what the possibilities of the Ukraine-Russia conflict going nuclear are. My personal opinion, knowing a little bit about the people of both of those countries from personal experience, is that I do not think by any stretch of the imagination, if it was left up to the Ukrainians and the Ruskis, Russians, I don't think that conflict would go nuclear. And one of the reasons I don't think it would is because, number one, to win that conflict, I don't think Russia has to go nuclear in the long run. Do you?
Well, again, I don't believe that Russia can win the conflict at all anyway. I mean, there's nobody winning this, in my view.
Yeah.
But I think the big concern and what's out there right now in the public sphere and certainly in the media is a lot of hype and a lot of concern and a lot of people that are screaming about the potential use of nuclear weapons in the theater. But you have to look at this from a very, I suppose, not only analytical but realistic point of view, understanding what the benefits or the negatives of using a weapon like that.
Yeah.
So let's say
what do you think are the benefits, for example, of either country of Ukraine using nuclear weapons? And conversely, what do you think are the benefits of Russia utilizing nuclear weapons, with the end goal in mind being for each party? The Ukrainians, the end goal would be to save their independence. The Russians, number two, the end goal would be to exert power and influence over Ukraine.
Yeah, here's the problem. Ukrainians don't have nuclear weapons. They gave them up in the early 1990s on agreement with Russia, with the agreement from Russia, the United States, and the UK, that the UK, Russia, and the United States would all protect Ukrainian sovereignty if they would hand those nuclear weapons back to Russia. It's called the Budapest Agreement.
Yes.
I think signed by with the Clinton administration in 1994. And it basically guaranteed the sovereignty and the borders of Ukraine with Russian protection as well as UK and US protection.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, that's been broken since 2014. But the Russian concern and what people are worried about is this expanding into a broader nuclear conflict because of the NATO pressure and the NATO support to Ukraine that is really causing more difficult conditions for the Russian military.
Well,
so the theory is...
Let's talk about the latest support for Ukraine. Do you want to quantify that a little bit, Jim?
Well, I mean, Germany, the United States,
right,
France,
right.
They are all providing heavy armor, tanks, sophisticated Western tanks. There's been, you know, over $100 billion worth of support from the United States to Ukraine. There's been tens of billions of dollars of other NATO country support to Ukraine and training and equipment. So that's all happening right now, which is giving the Ukrainians the ability to actually defend against the Russian forces.
Yeah.
It's costing casualties, massive, large numbers of casualties on both sides. Remember, the United States had about 250,000 deaths in World War II. Between the two countries, they've are probably approaching that number right now in less than a year worth of war.
Yeah.
But the real concern here, Al, and what we really want to focus on is this potential threat for nuclear exchange. And it's the idea that Putin is looking at a tactical nuclear weapon as just another weapon is not very realistic. And I can tell you why. So there's a certain when you use a tactical nuclear weapon, and these are low yield, very low yield weapons. In fact, in the 0.3 kiloton, the Hiroshima bomb was about 15 kilotons. So it's a small tactical nuclear weapon, but it still leaves a high radiological signature. It would spread very quickly through a mushroom cloud, and it would spread americium, cesium, strontium debris all across NATO borders.
Yep.
That would initiate a NATO Article 5, not Article 4 discussion, but Article 5 defense posture. So NATO would have to would respond to a tactical nuclear weapon going across the border. Now, here's the deal. Why in the world would you use a small yield weapon that could potentially cause a NATO Article 5 response for a very small tactical advantage?
I don't know. You might
kill a tank formation, you might kill a large number of infantry, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to use a tactical weapon and potentially create a global thermonuclear war. From the Russian perspective, there's not much benefit for a tactical weapons use.
Yeah.
And it's very clear to identify the signature, where it came from, what the command structure was, and our intelligence tracks this type of stuff very carefully, very closely, to see when a nuclear weapon is moved into a theater. Be very identifiable.
Jim, I got a question for you. Do we need more time on this subject? The reason I say that, I have a couple of questions I want to ask you about it, but we're winding down. We've only got 7 minutes left, and we have to take a commercial break. I have to take that commercial break right now, which I'm going to do. And stick around, Jimmy and I will be right back.
your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Time for another segment of KER Politics. This one is kind of fun because I can really feel, for lack of better terms, the gravity of the situation in the Ukraine and in Russia. Jimmy, let's wrap this one up and then let's go on and let's talk about the what you call the nuclear laptop. But from now on, let's talk about the possibility of the Ukrainian-Russian conflict morphing into a nuclear conflict.
Well, I don't believe that because of the signature of a nuclear weapon, because of the limited assistance that it would provide strategically for the Russian forces, that a tactical nuclear weapon would not be viable, that there's way too much risk involved in using a weapon like that. There's nothing's out of the, out of the question when you have this type of a conflict. So there's always the possibility.
Yeah.
But it would make very little sense for the Russians to take such a risk. They've got the world's largest stockpile of weapons, approximately 4,000 strategic large yield weapons, missiles that would on submarine based, air based, and land based missiles that would hit targets in the United States or anywhere around the world. But they've got roughly about 2,000 tactical nukes, and those tactical nukes have different yields, small yield, very small yield, which would be the size of a large conventional warhead maybe. But the possibility, the ability to track them, the ability to what tactical advantage it has is limited, and the risk is so high, it's so high that NATO would respond, and truthfully, the Russians are having a difficult time with the Ukrainian army. If there was an Article 5 response, the Russian government would be severely at risk at a massive response from European and U.S. NATO allies.
Yeah, so, I agree 100% on that, Jim. And let me just make sure I understand this correctly. Using what I'm going to call the smaller nuclear weapon, and I'm just doing that for simplicity's sake, you made an example in the prior segment, which you said a weapon like that would probably be useful in taking out something like a tank squadron or something like that. But my question is, I don't think you really have to use any type of nuclear weapon to accomplish that, Jim.
Well, no, it'd be cover a wider area, a large infantry mass formation or a tank unit, a large formation of equipment. Yeah. However, many of these armored systems are designed to actually operate in a radioactive environment. So you'd have to destroy the weapon system. There is a possibility to use it as an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse that would shut down communications between units.
Yeah.
That, again, would create bigger problems. But the real problem is the radioactivity, the strontium, the cesium that would flow up from the atmosphere and cross borders could potentially cause tremendous damage and loss of life in NATO border countries.
Yeah, it would seem to me that the positives do not outweigh the negatives in this particular action. They don't do it at all.
It's a very high risk. In the 1950s and the early 1960s, we had a nuclear strategy called MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction, that we'd blow each other up and the world would be over with, and that kept people from potentially using nuclear weapons.
Right.
That's what we'd be equating here. The escalation for a nuclear war would create that. That would be both homicidal and suicidal for a Russian government to be first use tactical nuclear weapons. And there would be no justification if they're doing it on Ukrainian soil, because in fact, it is Ukrainian soil and it's not a direct threat to the Russian integrity or their borders.
Yeah.
Now that would change if there was a vast movement into Russia for Ukrainian forces or some NATO forces, but that doesn't look likely. There's no real definition of an objective for that right now, so it doesn't appear to be.
That's very certain. It's really a shame that all of these negative factors would come out of a situation that I think that Putin felt was pretty much of a small situation. In other words, Russia would take over the Ukraine, boom, end of story, and there wouldn't be any problem. My God, Jimmy, look what it's turning into. It's turning into the biggest nightmare that Vladimir Putin has ever had in his life as a leader of Russia.
Tens of thousands of young men are dying for, you know, just for no reason.
Right.
In a foreign soil. And you've got to remember this. They're fighting, okay, the whole idea that there's some Russian ethnicity along these areas in Crimea and along the eastern edge, they're fighting on foreign soil.
Yeah.
They invaded foreign country. This is not protecting the motherland like in World War II.
Yeah.
So the nationalism, and there's a lot of people that support this because they see one side of it, and they see, you know, the fear of NATO and the fear of Western expansion into their region that's been perpetuated by the government.
Yeah.
They see that, but at the same time, this is dragging, costing them a tremendous amount of lives,
yeah,
a tremendous amount of money. It's costing them economically in the long term. It's going to cost relationships, very deep relationships. So you have to wonder what the ultimate goal and why this happened. And, you know, we've seen historically what happened to a Russian leader, a czar, Nicholas, yeah, when he got involved in World War One and lost on foreign shores. It overturned his government, and the next few generations were absolutely catastrophic under Soviet rule.
Yeah. Well, I agree with that 100%. I think this is one of those events in history that has turned out and will culminate as a huge mistake, because there is a possibility that this could escalate into World War III. I really believe that. That would only happen if the leaders of the stronger countries, if the leaders of the world powers, and let's say the European Union, and let's say the United States, and let's say China, if all of those people decided this thing was just too much of a danger to them, to their countries, to their respective countries, they went ahead and got involved in it. That would be the worst thing in the world, Jim, that could happen, in my opinion. By the way, we're down to about 30 seconds in this one.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, we're going to see an escalation. You're going to see probably a Russian advance, a Russian offensive coming up in the next few weeks, and we'll see continuation of this violence for a long period of time,
right,
until somebody, so cooler heads prevail.
Well, I hope that happens. I've seen a lot of articles that have come on that have basically said it looks like the Russian offensive, and I'll use the word major offensive, is going to start at some point within just maybe 3 to 5 weeks. If that's the case, that could be a good thing, or that could be a really bad thing. If they took out Ukraine, which I'm not going to give an opinion on that one, I'm just going to say, if they took out the Ukraine, this particular situation would be truly under the rug. You guys, time for the top of the hour news. We'll be right back.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Top of the hour news is over, so Al and Jim get to take over for at least two more segments, which is the better part of half an hour minus commercials. Jimmy, let's wrap up the situation in the Ukraine. We talked about it pretty much in the prior two segments. Let's wrap it up right now.
Right. And I think, the last segment you talked about the possibility of Russia actually overtaking Ukraine. And I think if that was ever the objective, I think it was probably objective to change the leadership in Kiev to a more favorable government. But the probability of the Russians being successful at that is very slim right now. And here's why I believe it is. The Ukrainians have gotten a tremendous amount of weapon support, more sophisticated systems, tow anti-tank weapon systems, a lot of handheld systems. They're going to have a defense in depth. The Russians will use their tactics of massive suppressive fires, artillery, air strikes, cruise missile strikes in order to prepare for an offensive if they move on that. But as the Russians maneuver, they're going to hit a very deep defense that is echeloned in order to counter their armor and, of course, hit their supplies deep yeah. with some of these very sophisticated artillery systems. So it's going to be a tough haul, a lot of probable casualties on both sides, very ugly. That is not good for anybody.
No, it's not. I'd say what's not also not good for anybody, and that is we've only got about 8 minutes and 30 seconds left to wrap this up, and we want to talk about something very important, and that is the atomic laptop. That is still causing mucho problema for the Democrats. Go ahead, Jim, talk about that.
Right. So it's atomic. It's radioactive because it just, you know, like radioactive material, it continues to spread death and destruction. And if we go back into the history of what happened here, you know, Hunter Biden had been benefiting from his father as a senator and as vice president for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And he also had some very serious personal problems.
Yes, he did.
His laptop showed a tremendous amount of just debauchery, for one, but also have a lot of information of relationships with with oligarchs, with Ukrainian corrupt officials, with Chinese military intelligence officials, as well as government officials, and a lot of information about using his father as a tool for getting contracts.
Right.
That's problematic in itself, but he never admitted that it was actually his until this week when a legal team is attempting to sent forward a referral to the Delaware Attorney General. The Delaware Attorney General is a close friend of the Biden family, apparently, and sent a letter to them asking to prosecute the computer repair individual that had the laptop and turned it over to both the FBI and to Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, and eventually it came to the Washington Post, where it was turned over with, you know, a lot of very, very negative information yeah. on the administration, as well as Hunter and his close associates.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's got a real bucket of worms that he opened up. There's no question about that. But my question, from a practical standpoint, is there a lot of negative things coming out about the current executive office and the people who are, you know, there? Now, my question is this. None of these, I'm going to call them allegations. None of these allegations have really helped the Democrats at this point in time all that much. You want to comment on that?
You mean didn't help the Republicans that much?
Yes, I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, so the Democrats are having to scramble. And the reason why the Republicans, they hadn't benefited from it, obviously, because in 2020, when this information was released in an extensive Washington Post story, the tech companies, big media corporations, as well as senior government officials claimed that this was Russian disinformation.
Yeah.
And of course, with this accusation that somehow they were benefiting from targeting Hunter Biden, his legal team, this legal team that is now representing Hunter Biden, that we don't know where the money came from, but we've got talking about very expensive lawyers. They've now gone on the offensive to try to attack people that had any connection to this laptop. And of course, the poor computer owner that tried to get a hold of Hunter Biden to return it, the computer shop repair owner, he tried to give the laptop back. He went past his time, and then he finally looked at it after, you know, a few months. I think it was a minimum 90 days, and then he tried to contact Hunter numerous times. He didn't respond. He saw what was on it. He turned it over to law enforcement. He turned it over to a former federal prosecutor, the former mayor of New York, a very powerful, influential guy, who, by the way, was the lawyer for the president of the United States at the time, thinking that he would get some sort of, there'd be some follow-up with this criminal activity that was identified on the laptop. And what we see is the Democrats pulling together with law enforcement officials and with senior intelligence community officials in order to discredit and discount it and protect the White House and Biden. Now, this is problematic because as you get more information from the classified documents that were found in Joe Biden's house and in the Penn Center, the research institute that he was running at University of Pennsylvania, there may be specific documents that were used for information, classified documents that were used to help Hunter Biden get information or have influence that he used to benefit himself from the classified documents from his dad that had him illegally at his home.
Well, you know, of course there are, and that's what we've been talking about. That's what the American public has been talking about for almost the last 2 years now. Now, the reason that I think it's okay and it's not a waste of time to be talking about that at very high levels is because what I'm hearing from all the material I have read is that the laptop, Hunter's laptop, seems to serves a point of proving Joe Biden to be somewhat sloppy in his actions.
Well, there's a lot of information on it, but the most disturbing pieces of it is actually how law enforcement has treated this entire issue and the White House.
Yeah.
The White House has made numerous comments that have been proven false. First of all, they said all the review was done and they'd searched the home and there was, you know, no classified documents there. They falsified that. They came out later and said, oh, there's more documents. With the laptop, they're completely ignoring that, trying to cover it up. But then the Democratic Party is hiring massive groups of lawyers to attack people that were somehow connected or involved with. This is exactly what happened with the Ashley Biden, Joe Biden's daughter's diary.
Yeah.
Joe Biden's daughter left her diary at a halfway house after drug recovery in Florida. Somebody found it. And the government went after and prosecuted the people that found it because they were trying to sell it, and then actually went after the journalists that this information was given to and raided Project Veritas's home. So what we have is the abuse of power. It's absolutely unprecedented in American history because it's so public. And I think that's going to have, in the long term, this is going to erode eroding the credibility of the White House, Joe Biden, his entire family, and Department of Justice.
I completely agree with that. I got to tell you, if I were Jill Biden, I would look for a politically correct way to escape this environment if that was possible, because I can't I just don't understand why she would want to be involved in something like this, because Joe Biden is going to go down in history not only as being a corrupt president. No question about that. You guys stick around. We're going to wrap it up here. In the next segment, we're going to wrap up the whole show. To wrap up KER Politics, you know, I have to tell you, I think this was a pretty interesting show. We seem to be focusing on all the negative things that are going on in society, but the fact of the matter is these negative things are of a much greater magnitude than a lot of the events that the newscasters talked about, let's say, 5 or 6 years ago. Jimmy, let's talk again about the Chinese balloon and the other problems that we're having.
Yeah, this has not been a good week, nor a good year, nor a good administration for the Biden team. What they're facing with today is this: the revelations that the Chinese have a balloon that's crossing the northwest United States, moving eastward towards the central U.S. at about 60,000 feet, that appears to have an intelligence collection capability on board.
Now, let me ask you, Jimmy, do you think this is a prelude to the Chinese taking some military action for whatever reason? I mean, God knows there's a lot of reasons out there that one could point to.
Well, I do think that this balloon activity, and apparently the Canadians have identified a second balloon. I'm not sure about the reporting on that at this point, but the Department of Defense has verified this first balloon was from China. The Chinese have acknowledged that it was their balloon, that it was a mistake, apparently. And of course, what I would speculate, it apparently has its, again, traveling at about 60,000 feet. It's above most air travel and actually out of the reach of most aircraft. So it has some sort of a package underneath. My guess is one of two issues with this, and maybe a combination of both. The first one is that their overhead space capability intelligence collection has a shortfall, and they needed to get a better collection capability closer to the areas across the western United States, northwestern United States, primarily the nuclear facilities and, of course, telecommunications networks and, of course, geo-mapping of all those locations. And that would show a gap in their intelligence capability. The second aspect would be a very bold public statement that they basically have zero respect for the Biden administration, because it turns out that Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, was supposed to be traveling next week in an unannounced visit to Beijing to meet with the Chinese leadership, with their foreign minister, to discuss the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
Yeah. Well, that's very possible. I think this is a prelude, personally, for some type of military action by the Chinese, and I think they are ascertaining right now just how much of a foe the United States could be. Their action could be anything from getting involved in the Ukraine to getting Taiwan back. Both of those would be pretty negative actions for the United States.
Well, I think the primary purpose would be to, again, collect specific intelligence data. But look, the Russians, the Chinese, many of these countries that we are, you know, in opposition against or competitors with, they send very clear signals. And this is a very clear signal. You know, a massive balloon over your airspace is not something that just kind of flows by. It could be a test to see if we're able to, if we're capable of identifying it, and then they could put some other type of system in there, maybe an EMP system. I hear some speculation. I see that on some of the websites that there could have been an EMP, electromagnetic pulse weapon aboard, something like that, or could be in the future, that would create massive outages of electronic communications in the United States, and potentially shut down the networks that our defense systems are on. So that's a frightening thought. No matter what, it's preparing for something, and it's definitely sending a signal. And, you know, the Chinese government has stated very clearly that they want to reintegrate Taiwan, that Taiwan is a rogue province from mainland China. And, of course, economically, Taiwan is getting more powerful with Europe. It's very closely aligned with the United States. And there's very little fear of this administration taking any action after the debacle that they saw in Afghanistan. And, of course, being so bogged down with the massive resources we're pumping into Ukraine, the weapon shortages, and then the Chinese control of so many resources, rare earth metals, as well as, you know, basic manufacturing needs like aluminum, that are controlled by markets controlled by Chinese businesses and government, which makes it very difficult for the United States to defend if they were to take action.
Jimmy, I'll tell you something. I think this may sound way out in left field, but I don't think it is. I think the actions within Congress that are perpetrated by the AOC coalition, I will call them, I think they show that the United States is not together in terms of working to solve problems. I mean, when you have someone like Omar standing up and being as passionate as she was about being asked to leave or told to leave one of the committees, I think it shows that And this is on top of
Adam Schiff and
Adam Schiff. Yeah, it really shows that our country is really disorganized in its administration and organization.
Well, I think so. I don't really look. It's politics are always ugly. I wouldn't say that these two events are anything out of the norm. In fact, it just happened in the last congressional hearing that they kicked out Republicans, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene. So that's nothing really new. Politics are politics. The uglier the politics, actually, the more open it is to the public. There are a lot of factors that are distracting, and there's a lot of things that are happening underneath that are being driven by other powers and other information controllers that basically take away Americans' full knowledge of what's happening in a, out in the world right now. We are being distracted by many, many issues. But the bottom line is the inability of a governing leadership to either protect its own interests or protect the interests of its people is not a legitimate government, in my view. And what we're seeing here with the Biden regime is they really have lost the bubble on protecting American interests in so many ways, on the border, on the economy, on crime, certainly with international and foreign policy issues. And this just unbelievable continuation of with no strategy to in Ukraine, very damaging to the United States, very damaging to stability in the world, because the United States, like it or not, is the biggest economy and has the biggest military capability. But right now we have the most incompetent leadership this nation has ever seen.
Well, I have to tell you, I think this open border on the south is showing the Russians and the Chinese just how ineffective the we as an organization are. I mean, can you imagine if some burg adjacent to China said, you know, we're now independent, we're not part of your deal? They would just go in and annihilate them.
Well, and so is it ineffective or is it planned? This is the question.
Yeah.
Is the Biden administration basically meeting the requirements from very influential lobbyists that are being controlled by other interests? For instance, the Chamber of Commerce. They want borders open so they can get more labor in the United States. The Chinese government, you know, they want control of tech companies in their country, but they want tech countries to control information in the United States. There's a lot of powers out there, a lot of ideologically driven, influential financial powerhouses that are driving these agendas that I think are very focused on globalization and look at other markets, and they think they can buy their way out of problems. Unfortunately, it's to the detriment of the United States and the average Americans that are working here trying to make a living.
I think you're right. I think you're 100% right. And I think basically what we're saying here as we conclude the show in about 20 seconds is that the United States has slipped to the status of, yes, we're the biggest power in terms of what we've done in the past, but in terms of what we're doing in the contemporary world, we are absolutely ridiculous.
This is how nations collapse, Al.
Yeah, exactly. And that is such a shame. Ladies and gentlemen, we are pretty upset right now about what's going on. Let us know how you feel about it, and we will be back next week.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.